Liberty by John Stuart Mill, first published in 1859. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. First half of Chapter 2, Liberty of Thought and Discussion. It is to be hoped that there is no longer any need to defend the liberty of the press as one of the protections against corrupt or tyrannical government. No argument for this, we may suppose, can now be needed. No legislature or executive, whose interests aren't exactly the same as the people's, should be allowed to tell them what to believe, or to decide what doctrines or arguments they shall be allowed to hear. This aspect of the liberty issue has been so often and so triumphantly enforced by previous writers that there is no need for me to make a special point of it here. Though the law of England is as unfriendly to freedom of the press as it was 300 years ago, there is little danger of its being actually enforced against political discussion, except during some temporary panic, when fear of revolt drives ministers and judges from their proper course. Generally speaking, it isn't likely that the government in a constitutional country, whether or not it is completely answerable to the people, will often try to control the expression of opinion, except when by doing so it expresses the general intolerance of the public. Let us suppose, therefore, that the government is entirely in harmony with the people, and never thinks of coercing anyone except in ways it imagines the people want. But I deny the right of the people to exercise such coercion, whether directly or through their government. The power of coercion itself is illegitimate. The best government has no more right to it than the worst. It is at least as noxious when exerted in accordance with public opinion as when it is exerted in opposition to it. If an opinion were held by all mankind, except for one person who had the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he would be in silencing mankind, if he could. You might think that silencing only one couldn't be so very wrong, but that is mistaken, and here is why. If an opinion were a personal possession, of no value except to the person who has it, so that being obstructed in the enjoyment of it was simply a private injury, it would make some difference whether the harm was inflicted on only a few persons or on many. But the special wrongness of silencing the expression of an opinion is that it is robbing not only one individual but the human race, not only the present generation but posterity, not only those who hold the opinion but those who dissent from it. Indeed, the dissenters are wronged more than the proponents. If the opinion in question is right, they are robbed of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth, and if it is wrong, they lose a benefit that is almost as great, namely the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth that would come from its collision with error. We need to consider these two cases separately. Each has a distinct branch of the argument corresponding to it. We can never be sure that the opinion we are trying to suppress is false, and even if we were sure of its falsity, it would still be wrong to suppress it. First, the opinion the authorities are trying to suppress may be true. Those who want to suppress it will deny its truth, of course, but they aren't infallible. They have no authority to decide the question for all mankind and exclude every other person from the means of judging. To refuse a hearing to an opinion because they are sure that it is false is to assume that their being sure of something is the same as its being certainly true. All silencing of discussion is an assumption of infallibility, which is a good argument for condemning it. Many people have used this argument, but it's none the worse for that. Unfortunately, for the good sense of mankind, the fact that people are fallible doesn't carry nearly as much weight in practice as it is allowed to carry in theory. Everyone knows perfectly well that he is fallible, but few think it necessary to take any precautions against their own fallibility, or allow that the errors they admit they are capable of might include some opinion of which they feel very certain. Absolute monarchs, or others accustomed to unlimited deference, usually feel this complete confidence in their own opinions on nearly all subjects. People who are better placed than monarchs are, and thus sometimes hear their opinions disputed, or get set right when they are wrong, have the same unbounded confidence only in such of their opinions as are shared by all around them, or by those to whom they habitually defer. For the less confidence someone has in his own individual judgment, the more he relies on the infallibility of the world in general. And to each individual, the world means the part of it that he comes into contact with, his party, his sect, his church, his social class. By comparison with most people, a man may be called almost liberal and large-minded if to him the world on which he bases his most confident opinions is anything as comprehensive as his own country or the times in which he lives. The faith he has in this collective authority isn't at all shaken by his awareness that other ages, countries, sects, churches, classes, and parties have thought, and even now think, the exact opposite of what he does. He bestows on his own world the responsibility for being in the right against the dissenting worlds of other people. It doesn't bother him that mere accident has determined which of these numerous worlds is the one he relies on, that the causes that make him an Anglican in London would have made him a Buddhist or a Confucian in Peking. Yet it is perfectly obvious that ages are no more infallible than individuals, because every age has held many opinions that subsequent ages deemed to be not only false but absurd, and it is certain that many opinions now generally accepted will be rejected by future ages. An objection that is likely to be made to this argument runs somewhat as follows. There is no more assumption of infallibility in forbidding the propagation of error than in anything else done by the public authority on its own responsibility. Judgment is given to men to be used, because it may be used erroneously. Are men to be told that they shouldn't use it at all? When they prohibit something they think to be pernicious, they are not claiming to be exempt from error. They are simply performing their duty to act, fallible though they are, on their conscientious convictions. If we were never to act in our opinions, because they may be wrong, we would leave all our interests uncared for and all our duties unperformed. An objection that applies to all conduct can't be a valid objection to any conduct in particular. Governments and individuals have a duty to form the truest opinions they can, to form them carefully, and never impose them on others, unless they are quite sure of being right. But when they are sure, it is not conscientiousness, but cowardice, to shrink from acting on their opinions, and to allow doctrines that they honestly think dangerous to the welfare of mankind, either in this life or in another, to be scattered abroad without restraint, just because other people in less enlightened times have persecuted opinions now believed to be true. Let us take care not to make the same mistake. But governments and nations have made mistakes in other matters that everyone agrees are fit subjects for the exercise of authority, such as imposing bad taxes and making unjust wars. Ought we, therefore, to impose no taxes, and whatever the provocation to make no wars? Men and governments must act to the best of their ability. There's no such thing as absolute certainty, but there is assurance sufficient for the purposes of human life. We may, we must, assume our opinion to be true for the guidance of our own conduct. And that's all we are assuming when we forbid bad men to pervert society by spreading opinions that we regard as false and pernicious. I answer, no. It is assuming very much more than that. There is the greatest difference between presuming an opinion to be true because it hasn't been refuted, though there has been every opportunity to do so, and assuming its truth as a basis for not allowing anyone to try to refute it. Complete liberty of contradicting and disapproving our opinion is the very condition that justifies us in assuming its truth for purposes of action. and on no other terms can a human being have any rational assurance of being right. Look at the history of what people have believed, or look at the ordinary conduct of human life. Why is each of these no worse than it is? It is certainly not because of the inherent force of the human understanding. Take any proposition that isn't self-evident. For every person who is capable of judging it, there are 99 others who are not. So why is there, on the whole, a preponderance among mankind of rational opinions and rational conduct? It is because the errors of the human mind can be corrected. This quality of the human mind is the source of everything worthy of respect in man, whether as a thinking or as a moral being. He is capable of correcting his mistakes by discussion and experience. Not by experience alone. There must be discussion to show how experience is to be interpreted. Wrong opinions and practices gradually give way to fact and argument. But facts and arguments can't have any effect on the mind unless they are brought before it. Very few facts are able to tell their own story without comments to bring out their meaning. So, because the whole strength and value of human judgment depends on a single property, namely, that it can be set right when it is wrong, it can be relied on only when the means of setting it right are kept constantly at hand. Consider someone whose judgment really is deserving of confidence. How has it become so? Through his conducting himself as follows. He has kept his mind open to criticism of his opinions and conduct. He has made it his practice to listen to all that could be said against him, to profit by as much of it as was sound, and expound to himself, and sometimes to others, the fallacy of what was fallacious. He has felt that the only way for a human to approach knowing the whole of a subject is by hearing what can be said about it by persons of every variety of opinion, and studying all the ways in which it can be looked at by every kind of mind. No wise man ever acquired his wisdom in any way but this, and the human intellect isn't built to become wise in any other manner. The steady habit of correcting and completing his own opinion by comparing it with those of others, so far from causing doubt and hesitation in acting on the opinion, is the only stable foundation for a sound reliance on it. Knowing everything that can be said against him, at least obviously, and knowing that he has looked for objections and difficulties, and has shut out no light that can be thrown on the subject from any direction, such a man has a right to think his judgment better than that of anyone who hasn't gone through a similar process. So the wisest of mankind, those who are best entitled to trust their own judgment, get that entitlement from the discipline of looking for difficulties and listening to objections. It isn't too much to require the same discipline to be submitted to by that miscellaneous collection of a few wise and many foolish individuals called the public. The most intolerant of churches, the Roman Catholic Church, even at the canonization of a saint, admits and patiently listens to a devil's advocate. The holiest of men, it seems, can't be admitted to posthumous honours until all that the devil could say against him is known and weighed. If we weren't permitted to question Newton's physics, even that wouldn't be as confidently accepted by everyone as it is now. Our best-supported beliefs have as their only safeguard a standing invitation to the whole world to try to prove them unfounded. If that challenge isn't accepted, or is accepted and the attempt fails, we are still far from certainty. But we have done the best that human reason is now capable of. We have neglected nothing that could give the truth a chance of reaching us. If the challenge continues to stand, we can hope that if there is a better truth, it will be found when the human mind is capable of receiving it, and in the meantime we may rely on having attained as close an approach to truth as is possible in our own day. That is how much certainty a fallible being can get, and that is the only way to get it. It's strange that men should admit the validity of the arguments for free discussion, but object to their being pushed to an extreme, not seeing that unless the reasons are good for an extreme case, they aren't good for any case. strange that they should imagine that they aren't assuming infallibility when, having accepted that there should be free discussion on all subjects that can possibly be doubtful, they hold that some particular principle or doctrine, this being the extreme case, ought not to be questioned, because it is so certain, that is, because they are certain that it is certain. If we call any proposition certain, while there is anyone who would deny its certainty if he were permitted to, we are assuming that we, and those who agree with us, are the judges of certainty, judges who don't hear the other side. In the present age, which has been described as destitute of faith but terrified of scepticism, people feel sure not so much that their opinions are true as that they wouldn't know what to do without them. So the claims of an opinion, to be protected from public attack, are based less on its truth than on its importance to society. This is alleged. Some beliefs are so useful, indeed indispensable, to our well-being, that governments have as much of a duty to uphold them as to protect any other of the interests of society. With that kind of necessity, on matters that are directly in the government's line of duty, something less than infallibility may permit and even oblige governments to act on their own opinion, when this is also the general opinion of mankind. Something else that is also often argued, and still oftener thought, is this. Only bad men would want to weaken these beneficial beliefs, and there can't be anything wrong in restraining bad men, and in prohibiting something that only bad men would want to do. This way of thinking tries to justify restraints on discussion, not through the truth of doctrines, but through their usefulness, and it hopes in that way to avoid having to claim to be an infallible judge of opinions. But those who are content with this don't see that they have merely shifted the assumption of infallibility from one point to another. The usefulness of an opinion is itself a matter of opinion, and is as disputable, as open to discussion, and as much in need of it, as is the opinion itself. Deciding that an opinion is dangerous, just like deciding that it is false, requires an infallible judge of opinions, unless a condemned opinion has a full opportunity to defend itself. In order to illustrate more fully the badness of denying a hearing to opinions because we have condemned them, I should tie the discussion to a concrete case. And I freely choose the cases that are least favourable to me, ones where the argument against freedom of opinion, on the score both of truth and of utility, is considered the strongest. Let the opinions in question be the belief in a God and in life after death, or any of the commonly accepted doctrines of morality. Fighting the battle on that ground gives a great advantage to an unfair opponent, who will be sure to say, "Are these the doctrines that you regard as not certain enough to deserve to be protected by law? Is the belief in a God one of the opinions that, according to you, one can't feel sure of without assuming that one is infallible?" Indeed, many who have no desire to be unfair will say this internally. I should point out that what I call assuming infallibility is not merely feeling sure of a doctrine, but deciding that question for others, without letting them hear what can be said on the contrary side. And I denounce and deplore this claim just as much if it is put forth on the side of my own most solemn convictions. However sure someone is, not only of an opinion's falsity, but also of its pernicious consequences, and even, to adopt expressions that I altogether condemn, of its immorality and impiety, if that private judgment leads him to prevent the opinion from being heard to defend itself, he assumes infallibility, even if his judgment is backed by the public judgment of his country or his contemporaries. And the assumption of infallibility is not less objectionable or less dangerous because the opinion is called immoral or impious. On the contrary, it is precisely with those opinions that the assumption is most fatal. It is on exactly those matters that the men of one generation commit the dreadful mistakes that arouse astonishment and horror in later generations. It is among them that we find the memorable historical instances where the arm of the law has been employed to root out the best men and the noblest doctrines. Let it never be forgotten that there was a man named Socrates, who came into a memorable collision with the legal authorities and public opinion of his time and place. Born in an age and country abounding in individual greatness, this man has been reported to us, by those who best knew him and his times, as the most virtuous man then alive. And we know him as the head and exemplary model for all subsequent teachers of virtue, the source of the lofty inspiration of Plato, and of the judicious utilitarianism of Aristotle, the master of those who know, as Dante called him. This acknowledged master of all the eminent thinkers who have since lived, a man whose fame, still growing after more than 2,000 years, nearly outweighs all the other names that make his native city illustrious, was judicially convicted and put to death by his countrymen for impiety and immorality. Impiety in denying the gods recognized by the state. Indeed, his accuser said that Socrates didn't believe in any gods. An immorality in being, through his doctrines and instructions, a corrupter of youth. We have every ground for believing that the tribunal honestly found him guilty and condemned to death as a criminal the man who was probably the best man who had ever lived up to that time. After the condemnation of Socrates, mention of most other instances of justice gone wrong would be an anticlimax, the one exception being the event that took place on Calvary rather more than 1,800 years ago. It involved a man who gave those who knew him such an impression of his moral grandeur that 18 centuries have done homage to him as God in person. He was ignominiously put to death. As what? As a blasphemer? Men didn't merely mistake their benefactor. They mistook him for the exact opposite of what he was, treating him as that monster of impiety that they are now held to be because of how they treated him. The feelings that mankind now have regarding these lamentable dealings with Socrates and with Jesus, especially the latter of the two, make them extremely unjust in their judgment of those who put the two to death. These seem not to have been bad men, not worse than men most commonly are, but rather the contrary, men who possessed a full or perhaps overfull measure of the religious, moral, and patriotic feelings of their time and people. Just the kind of men who at any time, ours included, have every chance of passing through life blameless and respected. The high priest, who tore his garments when he heard Jesus say, "Hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, and coming in the clouds of heaven." Words that, according to all the ideas of his country, constituted the blackest guilt, was probably quite as sincere in his horror and indignation as are the general run of respectable and pious men now in the religious and moral sentiments they proclaim. And most of those who now shudder at the high priest's conduct, if they had lived in his time and been born Jews, would have acted precisely as he did. Orthodox Christians, who are tempted to think that those who stoned to death the first martyrs must have been worse men than they themselves are, or to remember that one of those persecutors was St. Paul. Let me add one more example, the most striking of all, if the impressiveness of an error is measured by the wisdom and virtue of the person who falls into it. If anyone in a position of power ever had grounds for thinking himself the best and most enlightened among his contemporaries, it was the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. Absolute monarch of the whole civilized world, he preserved through life not only the most untainted justice, but also, surprising giving his stoic upbringing, the tenderest heart. The few failings that are attributed to him were all on the side of leniency, and his writings, the highest ethical product of the ancient mind, differ little, if at all, from the most characteristic teachings of Christ. This man, a better Christian than most of the ostensibly Christian sovereigns who have since reigned, persecuted Christianity. In calling him Christian, I mean this in every sense of the word, except the acceptance of dogmas. With an open and free intellect, and a character that led him to embody in his moral writings the Christian ideal, he nevertheless failed to see that Christianity would be a good and not an evil to the world. He knew that the existing society was in a deplorable state, but he saw, or thought he saw, that it was held together and prevented from being worse by belief in and reverence for the accepted gods. As a ruler of mankind, with a deep sense of his duty to the world, he thought it his duty not to allow society to fall to pieces. He didn't see how, if its existing ties were removed, any others could be formed to pull it back together. The new religion openly aimed at dissolving the existing ties, so it seemed to him that it was his duty either to adopt that religion or else to suppress it. Well then, the theology of Christianity didn't appear to him true or of divine origin. This strange history of a crucified God was not credible to him, and a system based on something he found so wholly unbelievable couldn't be foreseen to be an agency for renewal, which is what it has turned out to be on balance. For these reasons, this gentlest and most lovable of philosophers and rulers, acting on a solemn sense of duty, authorized the persecution of Christianity. To my mind, this is one of the most tragic facts in all history. It is bitter to think of how different the Christianity of the world might have been if its faith had been adopted as the religion of the Roman Empire under the auspices of Marcus Aurelius, instead of those of Constantine. But in fairness to him, and to the truth, it must be admitted that any plea that can be urged for punishing anti-Christian teaching today was available to Marcus Aurelius for punishing the propagation of Christianity. No Christian more firmly believes that atheism is false and threatens the dissolution of society than Marcus Aurelius believed the same things of Christianity. To anyone who approves of punishment for spreading opinions, I say, unless you flatter yourself that you are a wiser and better man than Marcus Aurelius, more deeply informed about the wisdom of your time, and more elevated in your intellect above it, more earnest in your search for truth, or more single-minded in your devotion to it when you find it, you should abstain from that assumption of the shared infallibility of yourself and the populace, the assumption that the great Marcus Aurelius made with such unfortunate results. Some enemies of religious freedom understand that they can't defend the use of punishment for restraining irreligious opinions by any argument that won't also justify Marcus Aurelius. And when hard pressed, they accept this consequence and say, with Dr. Johnson, that the persecutors of Christianity were in the right. They say that persecution is an ordeal through which truth ought to pass, and always passes successfully, because legal penalties are ultimately powerless against truth, but are sometimes beneficially effective against harmful errors. This argument for religious intolerance is remarkable enough to deserve scrutiny. A theory that maintains that truth may justifiably be persecuted because persecution can't possibly do it any harm is not hostile to the reception of new truths, but it is hardly generous in its treatment of those who bring such truths to mankind. To reveal to the world something previously unknown that deeply concerns it, to show the world that it had been mistaken on some vital point of worldly or spiritual concern, is as important a service as a human being can render to his fellow creatures. And in certain cases, such as the early Christians and the leaders of the Reformation, Dr. Johnson and his fellow believers think it to have been the most precious gift that could be bestowed on mankind. That the authors of such splendid benefits should be repaid by martyrdom, that they should be rewarded by being treated as the vilest of criminals, is not, on this theory, a deplorable error and misfortune, for which humanity should mourn in sackcloth and ashes, but rather is the normal and justifiable state of things. According to this doctrine, anyone who propounds a new truth should stand, like the proposer of a new law in the legislature of ancient Locris, with a halter around his neck, to be instantly tightened if the public assembly, after hearing his reasons, doesn't immediately adopt his proposition. People who defend this way of treating benefactors evidently don't set much value on the benefit. I think that this view of the subject is mostly confined to the sort of persons who think that new truths may have been desirable once, but we have had enough of them now. Anyway, the dictum that truth always triumphs over persecution is one of those pleasant falsehoods that men repeat after one another until they become common knowledge, but which all experience refutes. History teems with instances of truth put down by persecution. Even if not suppressed forever, it can be thrown back for centuries. To speak only of religious opinions, the Reformation broke out at least 20 times before Luther and was put down. Even after the era of Luther, wherever persecution persisted, it was successful. In Spain, Italy, Flanders, the Austrian Empire, Protestantism was rooted out, and it would probably have been rooted out in England too, if Queen Mary had lived longer or Queen Elizabeth had died sooner. Persecution has always succeeded, except where the heretics were too strong. No reasonable person can doubt that Christianity could have been wiped out in the Roman Empire. It spread and became predominant because the persecutions were intermittent, lasting for only a short time, and separated by long intervals of almost undisturbed Christian propagandizing. It is a piece of idle sentimentality that truth as such has an inherent power that error lacks, of prevailing against the dungeon and the stake. Men are not more zealous for truth than they often are for error, and the propagation of either will generally be stopped by sufficient application of legal or even of social penalties. The real advantage that truth has is just this. When an opinion is true, it may be extinguished once or many times, but through the centuries it will be rediscovered now and then, until one of these rediscoveries comes at a time when circumstances are favourable to its escaping persecution, until it has made enough headway to withstand all subsequent attempts to suppress it. This will be said. We don't now put to death the introducers of new opinions. We aren't like our ancestors who slew the prophets. We even build monuments to them. It is true that we no longer put heretics to death, and even against the most obnoxious opinions, modern feeling probably wouldn't tolerate punishments severe enough to wipe them out. But let us not flatter ourselves that we are now free from the stain, even of legal persecution. Penalties for opinions, or at least for expressing them, still exist by law. And even today, their enforcement is not so rare as to make it incredible that they may some day be revived in full force. In the year 1857, only 2 years before this essay was first published, an unfortunate man was sentenced to 21 months' imprisonment for uttering and writing on a gate some offensive words concerning Christianity. The man is said to be of unexceptionable conduct in every aspect of life. Less than a month later, 2 people, on 2 separate occasions, were rejected as jurymen, and one of them was grossly insulted by the judge and a lawyer because they honestly asserted that they had no theological beliefs. A 3rd person, a foreigner, was for the same reason denied justice against a thief. This refusal of remedy was based on the legal doctrine that a person cannot be allowed to give evidence in a court of justice if he doesn't proclaim a belief in a God, any God will do, and in a life after death. This amounts to declaring such a person to be an outlaw, someone excluded from the protection of the courts. It implies not only that he may be robbed or assaulted with impunity if no religious believers are present, but also that anyone else may be robbed or assaulted with impunity if the proof of the crime depends on his evidence. The underlying assumption here is that someone's oath is worthless if he doesn't believe in a life after death. Someone who believes this must be very ignorant of history, since it is historically true that many unbelievers in all ages have been people of distinguished integrity and honour. This proposition wouldn't be maintained by anyone who had the slightest conception how many of the persons with the greatest reputations for virtues and attainments are well known, at least to their intimates, to be unbelievers. Furthermore, the rule is suicidal. It cuts away its own foundations, on the claim that atheists must be liars. It accepts the testimony of all atheists who are willing to lie, and rejects only those who brave the disgrace of publicly owning to a detested creed, rather than affirming a falsehood. A rule, thus self-convicted of absurdity, can be kept in force only as a badge of hatred, a relic of persecution. And it is a very strange persecution, because what qualifies one for undergoing it is clearly proving that one doesn't deserve it. The rule and the theory behind it are almost as insulting to believers as to unbelievers. For if anyone who doesn't believe in a future state necessarily lies, it follows that those who do believe are prevented from lying, if indeed they are, only by the fear of hell. These indeed are merely rags and remnants of persecution, and may be thought to be not so much an indication of the wish to persecute, as an example of the common tendency of English minds to take pleasure in asserting a bad principle when they are no longer bad enough to want to carry it really into practice. But unfortunately, the state of the public mind doesn't give us a guarantee that the suspension of worse forms of legal persecution, which has lasted for about one generation, will continue. At this time, the quiet surface of routine is ruffled, as often by attempts to revive past evils as by attempts to introduce new benefits. The supposed revival of religion at the present time is always, in narrow and undeveloped minds, at least as much the revival of bigotry, and where there is the strongest permanent leaven of intolerance in the feelings of a people, as there always is in the middle classes of this country, it doesn't take much to provoke them into actively persecuting those they have always seen as proper objects of persecution. For it is this: men's opinions and feelings about those who disown the beliefs they deem important, that stops this country from being a place of freedom of thought. For many years, the chief harm done by legal penalties has been merely to strengthen the social stigma. It is the social stigma that is really effective. It is so effective that people in England are less likely to profess opinions that are under society's ban than are people in other countries to profess opinions that risk judicial punishment. Social pressures are, for those not wealthy enough to do without the goodwill of other people, as effective as law in suppressing unpopular opinions. Being imprisoned is no worse than being excluded from the means of earning a living. Those who have a secure income, enough to live on, and who don't want any favours from men in power, or from bodies of men, or from the public, have nothing to fear from openly declaring their opinions, except being ill thought of and ill spoken of, and they don't have to be very heroic to be able to bear that. There is no room for any appeal for pity on behalf of such people. But though we don't now inflict as much harm as we used to on those who think differently from us, it may be that by our treatment of them we do ourselves as much harm as ever. Socrates was put to death, but the Socratic philosophy rose like the sun and spread its illumination over the whole intellectual firmament. Christians were thrown to the lions, but the Christian church grew up as a stately and spreading tree, towering over the older and less vigorous growths and stifling them by its shade. Our merely social intolerance doesn't kill anyone, and doesn't root out any opinions, but it does induce men to disguise their opinions or to abstain from actively trying to spread them. With us, heretical opinions don't noticeably gain or lose ground in each decade or generation. They never blaze out far and wide, but continue to smoulder in the narrow circles of thoughtful and studious people, among whom they originate, without ever spreading any light, whether true or deceptive, on the general affairs of mankind. This maintains a state of affairs that is very satisfactory to some minds, because it keeps all prevailing opinions outwardly undisturbed, without the unpleasant process of fining or imprisoning anybody, and without absolutely forbidding dissentients, who are afflicted with the malady of thought, from exercising their reason. This is a convenient plan for having peace in the intellectual world, and keeping things ticking along in very much the way they do already. But the price paid for this sort of intellectual pacification is the sacrifice of the entire moral courage of the human mind. a state of affairs in which many of the most active and inquiring intellects find it advisable to keep to themselves the genuine principles and grounds of their convictions, and in their public statements do their best to fit their conclusions to premises that they silently reject, can't send forth people with the fearless characters and strong intellects that once adorned a thinking world. The sort of men it can be expected to produce are either mere conformers to commonplace ideas, or crowd-pleasers, whose arguments on all great subjects are meant for their hearers, and are not the arguments that convince them. Those who avoid both of these roles do so by narrowing their thoughts and interests to things that can be spoken of without getting into the territory of principles, i.e., to small practical matters that would fix themselves, if only the minds of mankind were strengthened and enlarged, and won't do so until that happens. Ironically, they are abandoning the very thing that would strengthen and enlarge men's minds, namely free and daring intellectual inquiry into the highest subjects. If you regard this reticence on the part of heretics as no bad thing, consider the fact that their reticence leads to there never being any fair and thorough discussion of heretical opinions, and ones that couldn't survive such a discussion, though they may be prevented from spreading, don't disappear. But the worst harm done by banning all inquiry that doesn't end in orthodox conclusions is not to the minds of heretics, but to those who aren't heretics, and whose whole mental development is cramped, and their reason intimidated by the fear of coming to accept what turns out to be heresy. Who can calculate what the world loses in the multitude of people who combine promising intellects with timid characters, people who don't dare to follow through any bold, vigorous, independent train of thought for fear that it will lead them to something that might be thought irreligious or immoral? Among them we may occasionally see some men of deep conscientiousness and subtle and refined understanding, who spends his life fine-tuning his faith with an intellect that he can't silence, using all his ingenuity, trying to reconcile the promptings of his conscience and reason with orthodoxy. No one can be a great thinker if he doesn't recognize that his first duty as a thinker is to follow his intellect wherever it leads. In the case of someone who, with due study and preparation, thinks for himself, even his errors do more to advance the truth than is done by the true opinions of those who hold them only because they don't allow themselves to think. Not that freedom of thought is required solely, or even primarily, to form great thinkers. On the contrary, it is even more indispensable for enabling average human beings to reach the highest mental level they are capable of. There have been, and may again be, great individual thinkers in a general atmosphere of mental slavery. But there never was, and never will be, in that atmosphere, an intellectually active people. Where the populace of any country has temporarily moved towards being intellectually active, that has been because the fear of unorthodox theorizing was temporarily suspended. Where, on the other hand, there is a silent understanding that principles aren't to be disputed, where the discussion of the greatest questions facing humanity is considered to be closed, we can't hope to find the generally high level of mental activity that has made some periods of history so remarkable. Whenever the big subjects, the ones important enough to kindle enthusiasm, were protected from controversy, the mind of the populace wasn't stirred up from its foundations, with even persons with very ordinary intellects being pushed towards the dignity of thinking beings. Such a push occurred in Europe, immediately after the Reformation. Another, though limited to continental Europe and to a more cultivated class, in the speculative movement of the latter half of the 18th century. And a third of still briefer duration in the intellectual fermentation of Germany during the period influenced by Goethe and Fichte. These periods differed widely in what particular opinions they developed, but they had this in common. During all three, the yoke of authority was broken. In each period, an old mental despotism had been thrown off, and no new one had yet taken its place. The push given at these three periods has made Europe what it is now. Every single improvement in the human mind or in human institutions can be clearly traced back to one or other of them. For some time now, it has seemed that all three of those pushes are just about exhausted, and we can't expect a fresh start until we again assert our mental freedom. End of first half of chapter 2.